From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made in classrooms all across New York State. And there's no simple answer to the question, what should teachers be teaching in high school English? But the Common Core standards have shifted some of the expectations, and it's possible that the result will include fewer works of classic literature, less great fiction. Are we ready to say goodbye to Boo Radley or Elizabeth Bennet or Holden Caulfield? Well, this hour we explore the value of teaching great literature. Our conversation was inspired by a recent interview with novelist and University of Rochester professor Joanna Scott. Scott wrote a piece for The Nation entitled The Virtues of Reading Difficult Fiction, and in our conversation she mentioned her concern about the impact of Common Core on teaching literature, especially in high school. One of our listeners happens to be a high school English teacher, and that comment struck a chord. I've welcomed her to continue our discussion on teaching literature and the value of the classics. My guests for the hour include Evie Fanning, English teacher at Pittsford Sutherland High School and devoted reader and teacher of the classics. Nice to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
Also here is Jillian Moore, who is a recent high school graduate and a student of Evie's. Nice to see you, Jillian.
Nice to see you, too.
I think it's important to start with the question of what exactly it was that Joanna Scott said on the show about Common Core and literature. And in a second, we're going to get a chance to listen to that. You know, again, if you missed that program, she was talking about great fiction. And Evie, you said, first of all, you had great affinity for the message she was sending.
Well, I was so inspired by what Joanna said.
Why was that?
Just because she made such a great point about what fiction has to teach us. That fiction in many ways can be truer than reality. That we can learn things that are not knowable otherwise. And I just listened to her and I was just kept nodding my head for an hour listening to your show that day.
Are you worried about the teaching of great literature going forward?
I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm not worried about it in my classroom. I'm very fortunate to be in a place where I have a lot of freedom to teach the things that I think are worth teaching. But definitely, I think that there's a trend away from fiction, away from the classics, towards informational texts, towards media literacy, that kind of thing. And I'm afraid that that might take something away from how much time we used to be able to spend on the classics.
Now, we've had conversations on this program with some of the regular listeners of this program who say media literacy is very important in the modern age, but I would think that you can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? You can teach media literacy without taking away the classics.
Yeah, one hopes so, certainly. And I kind of agree with you on that. I think that kids are really good at teaching themselves media literacy, and they take the initiative to do that as well. What they need our help with is reading the classics.
Well, I want to listen to what Joanna Scott said on this program specifically that kind of sparked some of this conversation. Again, she is an author and a University of Rochester professor, and this is her talking about some of her concerns.
One of the scariest things I saw was that in the Common Core, by 12th grade, students' reading should be almost entirely devoted to nonfiction. And one teacher's response to that was to say, well, we don't need to teach novels anymore. We just need to teach the basic ideas.
That is Joanna Scott saying her concern is that teachers are now being told, as long as you teach the basic ideas, you know, you don't have to really teach the entire novel. It's just the basic idea would be enough. And, you know, that's all you really need. That it's okay if you don't teach the entire piece of literature. So let me start with a student in the room. Jillian, can you imagine being told you're just going to read kind of a Cliff Notes version of a piece of literature?
I don't think I could fathom that. I think the actual experience of sitting in a classroom and having a teacher who genuinely loves the material that they're teaching telling you what you need to know about the basics, and then basically just prodding you and asking you the questions that need to be asked to get you thinking about what is important within that material is vital. I can't imagine a high school experience where I didn't have teachers asking me those questions and getting me thinking about things that I otherwise probably wouldn't have thought about.
Now, I don't know if you, again, you just graduated a couple of months ago.
I did.
You're fresh out of high school. Did you notice any impact of Common Core on the way things were taught?
I don't know what Common Core entails. To be completely honest, I tried to read up a little bit before this interview because I felt like I was missing something. But what I really got was that there's an emphasis on success, and I think there's an emphasis on success without defining success. And I think that in order to truly define success as we know it, we need great books. We need books that get us to think about truth and beauty and what we should be doing and where we should be going with our lives. And I think without these books, we don't have that.
I want to ask our listeners, what was a piece of great literature in your childhood? Maybe you read it in middle school or high school. Did it impact you? And what I want to know is this, did the text impact you? Did the way it was taught or the teacher impact you? I can think of books that I thought were drudgery and books that I thought were amazing the minute I picked it up and have stayed with me. And I sort of wonder if the teacher is a big component of that. We're going to be talking about that. But what pieces of great literature stayed with you and what would you want to make sure stays in the classroom? It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're not here to examine every aspect of Common Core for the hour, and that's not Abby Fanning's job, but I do want to ask you about something else Joanna Scott said, which is that by senior year under Common Core, 70% or more of a student's reading in high school is supposed to be nonfiction. And your thoughts about that?
Right. So we are supposed to make sure that students know how to read informational texts, right? And I agree, that's important. But we don't have to teach that skill by just sticking to nonfiction texts. We become better readers, better thinkers, better understanders, better human beings by reading great literature, by reading the classics. And so I can teach those skills by teaching the classics.
Is there a bias against fiction then for that reason, that you can't teach those skills if it's in a fictional sense?
I don't think so. No, I think, I think the nonfiction is kind of the lowest common denominator. We want to make sure that people know how to read a newspaper. We want to make sure that people know how to read an ad. We want to make sure that people know how to be great consumers. And that's all fine. I think that's all very important. But I personally have a higher goal of encouraging people to be great thinkers, great human beings, great questioners, great seekers of truth, great readers, great people, great humanitarians. And I think I teach all of that by introducing them to the classics. And by the way, that'll teach them to read informational texts. Oh, by the way, they're going to learn how to get information out of something that's nonfictional, how to write a great business letter. Sure, that will all come. If they know how to tell a story, if they know how to express their voice, and all of that comes with reading great literature.
The phones, by the way, just caught fire. We're going to be going to the phones in just a second. This is striking a chord with a lot of people as we talk about the way literature is taught or not taught going forward. Jillian, what's a book that was assigned to you that you might not have picked up otherwise? And look, Jillian is the kind of person, Evie warned me. She's an intellectual. She's very interesting. Maybe you would have picked it up otherwise, but maybe you wouldn't have. What was a book that stayed with you, for example?
A book that I probably wouldn't have picked up for a couple more years at least was Anna Karenina. And that's a heavy book to pick up, first of all. I read that this year. It was actually a prerequisite. It was summer reading. I read that, and it was a struggle. I'm not going to say it was fun reading the first time around. There were parts where I wanted to know nothing more about Russian farming. I just, you know, good for you, Levin, but I needed a break. And I read it, and it was taught, and then I read it again. I read it again this summer, actually, in a book club setting, and simply having teachers around me who cared about the material and have read the book time and time again, who pick up different nuances every time, gave me an appreciation for parts that I honestly would have skipped over. And I am a reader. I don't like to skip over parts in books, but there were some parts that were very hard to get to. And having someone who has found a way to love that, even in the difficult moments there, made it easier.
Now, this is interesting, because what Joanna Scott said on this program recently was, what we really need is sort of a cultural embrace of difficult fiction, even if it requires us to go back to a text. And so often now what we're hearing, sometimes Common Core related, sometimes not, is that we don't have time to even get through Anna Karenina the first time, let alone you as a student going back to it, reexamining with a teacher. What's your concern if some of these concerns that Joanna Scott brought are borne out and we don't do that in the future in high school classes? What are your concerns for students?
Okay, so the idea that you do not have time to read a book, I fundamentally disagree with. There are some things that I can't repeat. Like if I've watched a TV series, I'm not going to go back and rewatch it, but I will always reread a book because I know that I'm going to pull something different away from it the next time. And the idea that you don't have time to read a book kind of astounds me. I don't know how you could ever fail to prioritize something that could improve your life so dramatically.
So are you concerned then that if you've got these professors who see the Common Core landscape and you think about students like yourself, are you concerned that they won't be doing that? They won't be getting the value that you got?
I'm concerned that there might be a rush. I'm concerned that there's an idea that we need to get through the material and that there's an end game, that there's a very clear cut, you will get a job, you will be successful in life, you will have a family and money, and it's all there for you if you abide by the system that we've put in place. And I don't think that's true. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think it's ever going to be that simple. And I think that reading great books and taking the time to really analyze them and apply them to our lives, first of all, is probably one of the greatest tools we have.
I see why you brought her.
She's good, right?
She's very impressive. No, and she's bringing up so many important points. But I don't want to delay going to the phones because we've had a lot to wade through with our guests as we talk about the value of teaching literature, especially at the high school setting and in the context of asking what happens if we restrict it with the various new standards, including Common Core, among others. Ebbie Fanning's here, English teacher at Pittsford Sutherland High School, and Jillian Moore, a recent high school graduate. Let me start with Ed in Brighton. Go ahead, Ed.
Hi. I was a high school English teacher for over 30 years. I retired in about 2000. And one of the things that first of all, I'd like to say I hate the term Common Core because it seems to say we don't need extraordinary, just common. Everybody the same thing. But one of the things that I found late in my career is that if I offered some choice in terms of what students read, then when I got to the point where I said, we're all going to read the same thing and look at it together, they were much more willing to do that. It was a philosophy at the time called whole language. And during 2 months of the year, I would say, okay, now it's my turn. We're all going to read Catcher in the Rye and study it. But the other months, we might have a topic like war, and here are some possible titles, and everybody picked something different, you know, maybe 200, 250 pages, and we'll get together and talk about what we're reading and all of that. So I think that as an English teacher, I grew to not like the word classics because to me, The Catcher in the Rye is classic, and to other people, it's trash. And you know, it goes on like that. What is a classic?
And it's a very interesting point, and it's a timely question. We had a number of people online asking, can your teacher explain how you determine what you are teaching? Dorothy writes, glad that your teacher has the freedom to teach what she thinks is worth teaching. All English teachers should have that. Dorothy adds, by the way, just teaching basic ideas and not full text, can we devalue literature any further? And she says, I want teachers like Evie planning and writing a rich English literature curriculum for our kids. So Ed is saying, you know, he always felt like it was subjective, trying to figure out what's a classic. To him, Catcher in the Rye classic, to others, maybe not. What's your process, and how much freedom do you have in that process?
I am so encouraged to hear these comments. This is really great. I have an idea of what a classic is, and what a classic is a work of art that has stood the test of time, for one thing, which I think lends it great credibility.
So the term instant classic is an oxymoron to you?
I think so. I mean, as somebody who is trained in this discipline, I try to read contemporary texts and I try to pick out the ones that are like, is this going to be a classic? Is this going to make it? Is this going to stand the test of time? And I don't have the expertise to do that. And I don't know if any of us do. We do have to give it the test of time. That is what it is. So that's part of being a classic. But the other part that is so important is that a classic not just becomes a part of history, but a classic influences history. A classic in some ways defines other works of art that follow it. And so it becomes an influential work of art. So that's what a classic is to me. And there's a great advantage in classics in that we know that there's something of value there. We know that there's both technique and meaning and something that will speak to all of us. It's not just something that is characteristic of the time period out of which it came, but it is something that is universally applicable. It is something that speaks to the human condition. It's something that is relevant to all of us in any time.
So there's no list that you're given that it has to be two of these, it has to be one of this?
That I'm given?
Yeah.
No, okay. No, there isn't. Again, I'm very fortunate in that regard. But I can choose the classics that I teach, and I have some freedom to tailor that year to year, depending on what group of kids I have and depending on what their interests are. Because another great thing about classics is that there are so many of them. The canon is huge. I mean, we can decide where we go. We can decide what direction we take, and we do that regularly, you know. If they really like a particular, the classics are about everything too. Like everything that speaks to us on an emotional level and continues to speak to human beings on an emotional level is encapsulated in the classics. So if I have a class that's particularly interested in the gender struggle, we can take that direction. If there's a group that's interested in the class struggle or the race struggle, you know, we can change direction without going away from great literature, without going away from the classics.
And so what Ed is saying is it always felt subjective to him. It seems to me that you as a teacher, you've got a wide range that you can teach, that you're excited about teaching, but some of what you teach is kind of responding to some of the individual sort of DNA of the class at the time?
Sure, and it is subjective. A classic doesn't mean everybody loves it. A classic means that it has great value. I think we can apply that to any art form. There's something that we know is really good. That doesn't mean that it's our taste particularly. I mean, you and I have talked wine before, for example. We can tell when something is a great, well-made bottle of wine. It's not my exact taste. It's not what I would prefer to drink, you know, on my free evening. But we know that it's well-made. We know this is something really good. And it's the same in literature. It's the same in art. It's the same in anything else. We know when something is very well-made, it has value, it has merit. There's something to learn from this. It may not be my favorite thing, and that's subjective. But I will never shy away from examining it and learning from it.
I think that's so well said. Let me get back to the phones. And every single phone line is filled. We're going to try to get through as many of your calls as we can. Ellie in Fairport. You're next. Go ahead, Ellie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share an experience that I had back in high school in 10th grade. Our teacher, who also happened to be the drama teacher, he gave us a unique experience of reading a text out loud to us in class. So as a group, we all had copies of Catcher in the Rye in hand, but he spent a week or however many days reading it out loud to us. And that experience, even though, you know, we could have been taking the time in class to be, you know, going over something more specific, something that was more, you know, aligned with whatever a rubric was or whatever the standards were for this particular class, he took the time to do that. And let me tell you, everyone in that class, regardless of whatever stereotype they fell into, of, you know, a 15-year-old high school kid, everybody was glued to the text. Everyone was listening, enraptured by the way that he read this out loud to us. And I think even if something is assigned to us, everybody has, you know, everyone can go home and read it, whether or not they want to. But the way that he engaged us in a completely different level, we hadn't been read to since we were kids. It was a wonderful experience for us, and I still remember it so many years later because it was more than just reading a book and more than having a discussion. It was an experience, and I was really grateful for him for that still today.
Ellie, I'm so glad that you called to share that story, and that is so inspiring to hear that. Evie, you've got the big smile on your face.
I'm so excited to hear that. I absolutely do that, and I think it's an invaluable experience. And so many of us, we all love literature when we're little kids. When we're sitting in our parents' laps and we're having stories read to us, we all love that, right? Anybody who remembers being that age or anybody who has children that are that age know that this is the best thing in the world, is read a story to me. And for some reason, culturally, we let go of that at a certain age. And I think it's so awesome that she was able to embrace that again as an adolescent. And I wish that more people had that experience. I do the same thing in my classroom. I read all of Heart of Darkness to my freshman class last year out loud. It took 2 weeks. But it was great. It was a great experience for me. It was a great experience for them. The writing assignments that I got, you know, the kids writing at home while we were reading in class were some of the best writing samples that I've ever seen out of that class. And so, yeah, literature takes on very many forms, and I think we neglect too many of them because we're into this, like, we're in a rush, we have to get this done fast, we're into instant gratification, let's read the spark notes, let's just get the main ideas, and you can't do that with literature. You really have to take your time with it. If it means reading it out loud, then that's what we should do.
Jillian, would you have connected with the various texts that you read if you didn't have teachers that were dynamic?
Absolutely not. I actually, sophomore year, we had to read Hard Times, which has a reputation for being a difficult text that is kind of, it's grudging to get through. And I went into that class and I was like, I don't care what people say. I'm going to like this book. I'm going to like this book just because no one else is going to like this book. I'm going to do it. And I tried and I powered through it. And it was just not the dynamic experience that I had hoped for. It was a lot more content-based and did you read the material, which is to be expected, especially in a class where there are kids who don't care. There are sometimes, it comes up, not everyone wants to read a book. And catering to that, you lose that dynamic element. And in losing that, I mean, I didn't like Hard Times. I hope I can read it again, and I hope I can get that experience that I initially wanted on round two. But
I can actually relate to that. I remember, and my mother reminds me, coming home when I was in high school and saying to my mother, Shakespeare is going to die with my generation because I and all of my friends hate this book and we don't understand why our teacher is punishing us with this. And when we're in charge, there's no way that we're going to punish our kids with this. You know, but then the following year, I read another Shakespeare with another teacher and I decided that I want to study literature and I want to be an English teacher and I want to read everything Shakespeare ever wrote. And I'm still on that path today. So absolutely, I think the literature is part of it. But the whole point of having to teach it is that adolescents need help connecting with it.
I think Canterbury Tales and Shakespeare are at the top of the list that it does require some dynamism from the teacher. Because I hit a wall with both of those with the first time I encountered them. And I don't want to speak ill of past teachers. I just think there was an expectation that students will instantly grasp the greatness of this. And in some ways, it felt alien. Of course it did, right?
Of course it did.
Of course. And so the second time when I came, I was just like you. I was ready to give up on that stuff. And then the second time you come back to it, and it's somebody who is bringing it to life and telling you
right. It's
okay if this sounds like a whole other language. Right. And if you don't understand, let's talk about it. I felt entirely differently, and thank goodness for that. So I really take what Jillian's saying, and Ellie, what a great phone call. And really, I think we all can probably think of at least one teacher, but hopefully many, who made us feel alive with the text like that, because that clearly makes an impact. Let's go to George in Pittsford. Go ahead, George.
Yes. Hello, and thank you for this topic, and thank you for this marvelous panel.
Sure.
I want to relate briefly a memory I have of high school and poetry, which is often a stumbling block for students. But I remember very clearly as a sophomore, our teacher having us read Tintern Abbey by William Wordsworth. And then later in the year, when we were sitting with 20th century writers, we read the first two stanzas of Wallace Stevens' Sunday Morning. And he said to us, I'm not going to give you the rest of the poem. Some of you will want to read it on your own. I was one of those who chose to read it, even though I didn't understand at that time. And the love of poetry, I think, was born then. I think there is a fear behind the Common Core that students will not be, quote, competent, unquote, in order to handle the requirements of this new era. I worked as a paralegal. I worked as a Navy electrician. There is no job I've ever had, including dishwashing and ditch digging, where a love of literature did not make that experience either richer or enabled me to handle language in a way which made my job, handling my job better. So I think we need to free ourselves from that fear and give teachers the freedom to choose what they think is best for their students, because you never know. We all have a Tintern Abbey somewhere.
Well, George, thanks for the phone call. A reminder to our future callers, keep your radio turned down in the background. That's what you were hearing with George, but a lot of great points there. And Evie Fanning wanted to jump in. Go ahead, Evie.
One of the really great points that I think George made was that even if we don't understand something, continuing on with it might be a really valuable experience. And this fear that, like, oh, I don't get literature, I don't get classics, I don't get Old English, you know, and not that Shakespeare is Old English, but that's the idea out there among adolescence.
Chaucer, right?
Well. Right.
That's pretty old.
Shakespeare actually wrote in modern English. It sounds like old English, though, because we don't talk that way anymore. But the fact is that the more you read and the more you expose yourself to this stuff, even the parts that, you don't understand immediately, if we see that as a go sign instead of a stop sign, if we keep reading, you know those old pictures that, like, used to, like, it just looks like a whole bunch of colors, but you keep staring at it, and then a message comes up, or, like, a picture comes up out of it. I don't know if they have those anymore.
I hope they don't. They always give me migraines, but I'm very familiar with that.
But I feel like literature and poetry and all of that stuff is like that.
I take the point.
Even the stuff that's obscure, even the stuff that's confusing, trust that it's doing you good. Trust that there's a message in there. Keep going, and you will get it, and it'll be inspiring, and it'll be enlightening, and it'll be wonderful.
Except for what? Give me one. Now you really can start war. What's one so-called classic that you think is overrated that you don't want to teach?
Okay, sure.
You're going to do this?
I can do it. I won't teach Jane Eyre. I don't like it.
Jane Eyre.
You know, I understand. I get it. It's great literature. I know that. I know that people love it. I respect the people who love it. I understand what romantic literature has to offer us. It's just not for me. I don't like California cabs either. I understand that they're great wine. I don't like
them.
They're
not always great wine.
I like the other stuff better. So I see the value. I understand the value. I applaud the people who read it. I respect the people who love it. I don't love it. And if I don't love it, I'm not going to teach it, because my student will know it in a minute. I need to have the real passion. I need to have the real love for the material that I teach, so that they can get infected by that, so they can love it with me.
Very good. Val, do you want to grab the mic and join this fight now? Our engineer behind the glass says Jane Eyre is the best thing ever, and I think she's been physically wounded by that comment. But that's one of the really... Now she's going to be upset that I called her out. No, I think that's a fascinating part of this. Jillian, was there a text that you read that you thought, glad I read it? Yeah, I don't fully get it as a classic.
Ooh, off the top of my head, this is tough. I'm going to go back to Hard Times. I haven't had round two yet, so I'm going to go back to Hard Times.
But maybe the second time around.
Yeah, maybe it'll change.
Because you might have said the same thing about Anna Karenina, right?
I did, actually, the first time.
I hope Joanna Scott's listening, because so much of what she said about taking the time, pondering, really soaking in, maybe revisiting, we're finding the value, not only with our panel, with our callers. Let's get a break in, and if you're waiting on the phone, we're going to come back to you as we talk about the value of teaching and reading great literature and what happens next in our high schools because of the Common Core standards. This is not an hour to bash Common Core, to indict Common Core. And the heartening thing for me as a parent, but hopefully for all of our listeners, is listening to Evie Fanning, who is an English teacher at Pittsford Sutherland. She has the freedom still to set the curriculum. She's got the freedom to choose the text, and she's not backing away from teaching full and sometimes dense and sometimes challenging texts and really embracing that challenge. Is that going to be the case in every classroom? We don't know. We've heard some concerns that there will be more pressure to move quickly, to shorten the lessons because of Common Core, but so far, so good. Let's get a short break and get more of your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. The local Democrats have a new party chair. She's 30-year-old Jamie Romeo, and she says Democrats are poised to win. We'll sit down with her to find out how she plans to make that happen, particularly after years of losing local battles. Then in our second hour, we're talking about city chickens. Are you noticing more backyard chickens? It's all Tuesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Rochester Regional Health's Sands Constellation Heart Institute, with offices in Brighton, Greece, Dansville, and Geneseo. Caring for hearts in Western New York and the Finger Lakes for more than 15 years. For information, call 585-442-5320.
Each day, WXXI provides a forum for trusted, in-depth news programming. Hello, I'm Mindy Glazer, honorary co-chair for WXXI's Go Public campaign, helping to make sure WXXI is there for you whenever and wherever you choose. Make a contribution online at wxxi.org/gopublic, and thank you.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And I'd like to, again, Val, can we listen to that soundbite again from Joanna Scott? This entire conversation was sparked by a conversation I had with an author and a University of Rochester professor who wrote a piece for The Nation in this month's edition of The Nation called The Virtue of Reading Difficult Fiction. And she came on the program and said that she thinks there's such value in wading through dense fiction, even if it challenges you the first time, in considering it and thinking about it, in discussing it, and in opening your mind to it. You're hearing that from Jillian Moore, who's one of our guests. She's a recent high school graduate of Pittsford Sutherland, and Evie Fanning, an English teacher at Pittsford Sutherland High School. And then Joanna Scott, in that conversation on Connections a couple of weeks ago, said this.
One of the scariest things I saw was that in the Common Core, by 12th grade, students' reading should be almost entirely devoted to nonfiction. And one teacher's response to that was to say, well, we don't need to teach novels anymore. We just need to teach the basic ideas.
And Dorothy on Twitter says, doesn't that cheat the reader? And the answer we're hearing from our panelists is yes, absolutely. But maybe it's not going to be all of that way in English classes. You know, we had a question online from, let's see here. Oh, man, I'm trying to sort through so many comments. This is remarkable how much feedback we're getting. Someone had asked, and I apologize if I don't have it here, was asking, how does it break down, you know, when it comes to English class, Evie, are you going to feel pressure to shorten text or to do more nonfiction? It sounds to me like you're not getting quite that pressure right now.
Absolutely not. Okay. I'm not going to cut. I mean, who am I to cut Tolstoy or Shakespeare, right? Like that's so presumptuous, and there's no way that I'm going to do it. There is the tests that our kids have to take at the end of the year are more and more based on reading nonfiction texts, more and more based on reading informational texts, responding to them, but that's okay, because I can teach them those skills through Shakespeare and Tolstoy. We read narratives and we write with voice in response to whatever question we're asked. I think it's more valuable to human beings to read literature. I think that they'll read newspapers, they'll read online articles, they'll read blogs, they'll read ads. They will do that because they have to, and they'll teach themselves to do it. They may not pick up Anna Karenina. They may not pick up Hamlet. And it's my job to make sure that they do, because there are certain things that those texts have to teach us that are not readily available.
Well, some of our listeners said, I wish I had a teacher like Evie. And
thank you.
And what we're hearing as well from our audience and our panelists is the value of having a really dynamic teacher. Consider this. Jillian Moore, recent high school graduate, a Pew Research study recently found that 40% of college graduates say they will probably never read a full book again. 2 out of 5 people, and we're not talking about 2 out of 5 Americans, we're talking about people who graduated college this year. 2 out of 5 say, I'll probably never read a full book again. What do you think of that?
To them, I would ask, what's so much more important that they can't read a book? What else is so pressing that you can't sit down and read a book? A book is essentially a compilation of the entirety of human knowledge. It's the classics in particular are classics because they teach us things, they tell us things, they ask us questions, and they make us think about things that people have been thinking about since the book was written. Like, there are marriages that are shams, there are distractions that we surround ourselves with. These are things that we find out through Tolstoy. These are things that we find out through Tolstoy, and we see them every day. And so should we not turn to Tolstoy for answers?
It is pretty remarkable when you think 2 out of 5. You looked shocked when I read
I'm kind of astounded, to be honest.
Yeah, it is
It's a shortcut. I mean, really, think of literature as a shortcut. If you want quick answers, if you want quick results, you're not going to have time to live 8 lifetimes. But you can get the experience of 8 lifetimes through reading the classics written by 8 different classic authors. Take the shortcut. You know, read their ideas, read their life experiences, read what happened to those great characters and how they dealt with all the same things that you're going to have to encounter. Learn from their mistakes, learn from their successes, take advantage.
Let me grab another phone call. This is Amber. Go ahead, Amber.
Hi. Thanks again for going back to this topic. This is excellent.
Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to relate. Oh, great. I just wanted to relate a little bit of my own personal experience as a lifelong student of literature. So it started in the home, of course. And then as early as elementary school in 2nd grade, I belonged to we had a book club there. It was called Great Books. And I remember being excused from class to go discuss works of literature. I particularly remember reading Watership Down, and then I went on. I always loved literature, and in high school, I was in high school outside of Albany, and there was a class offered called Comedies in Literature, and I thought, oh boy, this is going to be so much fun. I signed up expecting, oh, we might read Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or something like that. Instead, we read Aristophanes, Euripides, Aeschylus, Shakespeare, and it was a big surprise, but even more surprising than the switcheroo I thought they pulled on me was how much I enjoyed that literature and how deep it was and how many levels there were and just how much you could interpret the world from understanding these great plays. And I went on to college, and I studied the Arthurian legend. I studied Shakespeare. I believe I read every text on the Arthurian legend that I could find, and Shakespeare introduced me to works of Ovid and Virgil, of course, and basically I went from there and became a great fan of world mythology, and later in life I went on to write plays, which are a culmination of those reading experiences. So the effect of those works of literature and many, many others on my life, not only were they mind-opening, they led me to explore the world, they helped me to understand pretty much every human circumstance that exists in the world, and they helped me establish myself as a writer. And that's all I have to say.
Amber, great phone call. What do you think, Evie?
Exactly. That's perfect. That's the classic literature at work. It defines a time, and it also influences history, and it influences other writers. And as we read these things, we see this web of great minds talking to each other and hopefully talking to us. And so we become part of this web of great minds, either through writing our own plays, as this caller did, or teaching, or raising children, or, you know, contributing to the world in whatever way, you know. And this kind of brings us back to this question between fiction and nonfiction, right? Between, like, do we read, is there really anything of truth to be learned from works of fiction? And there's a great distinction between fact and truth, right? Like, we can read nonfiction and gain facts, and that's important. We need to know facts. But there's truth that can be gained through literature. There's truth that we can learn. When I teach Romeo and Juliet, I think, you know, all of us have read that, right? If we've been through ninth grade, we've suffered through Romeo and Juliet. or we've loved Romeo and Juliet, depending on what our experience was like. But the fact is that 10 years later, I don't care whether you remember if Benvolio was a Montague or a Capulet. That's a fact. And that doesn't really matter. What matters is the truth of that play, the stuff that comes out of it, which is that, you know, love is stronger than hatred, that there are certain things that define us, that we can surpass ourselves, that we can become who we want to be. Like, all of these wonderful truths about the human condition that we can learn from it, that go far beyond facts, far beyond history, far beyond, you know, anything that we can learn from what has actually taken place, and more into the realm of who we might be, who we might become.
We have so many phone calls I'm trying to get through here and comments online. Caleb writes to us, how does the teacher deal with a situation where a third of the class read and comprehended, a third of the class read, didn't really comprehend, and a third did not read at all?
Jillian is giving me a dirty look as that question is being read, because of course I've been in that situation. Absolutely. And I have asked myself that question, and I have tried different things to deal with that. There was a time when I gave a reading quiz in the first 2 minutes of the class, and it turns out that two kids read and 12 kids didn't. And I said to the 12 kids, you're dismissed. Go. The three of us are going to have a conversation about what we read. I don't know if those 12 kids were like, oh, great, we got off easy, but maybe a couple of them thought, oh, maybe I'm missing out on something here. But I can tell you that the two kids that read, those two kids and I, had a great discussion, and it was wonderful, and it was thought-provoking, and it was enlightening for me.
So you have to make the effort first. You're not...
The student or the teacher?
The student has to at least make the effort.
Oh, my goodness. Teaching is not this is not me like putting information from my brain into yours. Absolutely not. If I'm doing my job well, then I'm inspiring you. I'm encouraging you to put in the work. You're not going to learn unless you do the work. Learning is something that comes from within you. I can ask you the right questions. I can give you the right texts. I can give you the right encouragement. I can role model. I can do all of those things. I can create the right environment. But you will only learn if you decide to learn. I can only create the favorable circumstances for you to learn, the right environment for you to learn. But you will only learn if you decide to learn. And so my job is to get people to want to learn.
Did you ever feel, Jillian, going into class that I read, but I'm not sure I've got my head around this, and how will that play in class?
Oh, absolutely. There were times where I had read the material, and then I had looked at the last couple paragraphs and then realized that I had comprehended none of it, and then reread the material and gone in the next day. And had it not been for the conversation that ensued, I would have gotten none of it. I would have left basically having not read the material. But I think the discussions that follow, if you've put in the effort and if you've tried to comprehend, are more valuable than what you would ever get reading and reading quickly and just getting it done.
Because it's not about the facts. It's not about the characters. It's not about what happens. It's about what questions come up in your mind as you're reading this about who you are, about how do you want to live your life, who do you want to be, what are you going to do? And that's the really valuable part. One of your listeners brought up Great Books, which is an awesome program that many schools have. And that program uses the Socratic method of conducting a discussion where the teacher actually only asks questions. There is nothing that the leader of that discussion says or imparts to the students. We all do the reading. We all talk about the book. But the leader of the discussion is only permitted to ask questions. So any information that comes up, any learning, any insights comes from the students.
Well, let me get Jake's comment. Maybe a tangent to what we're talking about here. Jake writes to us, a quote from Mark Twain I recently ran across is my current favorite. And the quote is this: "Don't let school get in the way of your education." He was speaking from the perspective of a person that failed in a conventional educational environment. And Jake says, "I can't help but want to put an incredible amount of weight on instilling in children the truth, which is simply, at the end of the day, the true responsibility for one's education is learning for themselves, not being taught." And that's essentially what Mark Twain was saying. What do you think, Evie?
I think he's absolutely right. I think Mark Twain is absolutely right. I think the thing is that kids want to learn. Kids are ripe for learning. They need the right environment for learning. The teacher's job is not to punish kids. The teacher's job is not to stuff anything down their throats. The teacher's job is to encourage exactly that curiosity. So yeah, when I walk into a classroom, I know what Mark Twain said. I know what Jake is saying. That's exactly what I want to do. I want to create the curiosity in the students to want to learn for themselves. And I want to be there as an aid so that when they have questions, I can point them in the right direction so that I can give them the right texts that will raise the right questions and get them thinking about the things that are real concerns in their lives. Classics are about the complexity of the human condition. I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself. I've probably said this before, but the fact is that is what books are about. And who feels the complexity of the human condition more keenly than teenagers? You know, that is what they're struggling with. That is what they're dealing with. You know, name a classic, anything that they're dealing with: love, jealousy, betrayal, self-doubt, faith. These are all things that we struggle with most in adolescence. We need the role models. We need the other people. We need the camaraderie of characters who are going through the same things to kind of hold our hand through it.
Before I get back to the phones, I'm going to go to the phones to finish the hour. Jillian, on that point then, what an interesting point that Evie is saying. Teenagers should be able to relate very, very well to the themes of so many of the classics. And yet the irony is, I would think a lot of teenagers, if my own memory is correct, looking around English class, in classes where we didn't have a dynamic teacher, a lot of teenagers were saying, how am I supposed to get this at all? What did you experience with your classmates?
I think there's a roadblock. I think there's a roadblock, and sometimes there's a gap that teachers have an obligation to bridge between, here's a book set in its time period, so distant from you, and here's your life. And I think that the teachers who can bridge that gap, who can bring the book to you and get those questions started in your head, the questions that make you realize what you have in common with so-and-so character and that you're going through the same struggles, you start to realize that you are feeling the things that the characters are feeling, but you as a teenager are feeling them with a ferocity, you know? You're feeling them perhaps stronger than you will 20 years from now, so what better a time to read?
I love that. let's get back to the phones, and this is Emmett in Rochester. Go ahead, Emmett.
Yeah, I was responding to, everyone seemed to respond to this survey saying that 2 out of 5 college students were saying when they get out of college they may not read for a while.
Might not read ever, might not read a single book ever
again.
They may not
read another book.
Yep.
And everyone sort of reacted like, it's like that was the student's fault. Personally, and I am a teacher, I'm a special ed teacher, nothing has decimated my reading more than being in university. I had a history degree at the U of R first time. Second time I went to got a master's. I had to read, 4 books a week in one class frequently. I stopped reading for like a couple of years. Grapes are wonderful. But I had to read, I was like, I would walk to the store reading, walking across crosswalks. If I could read while I was driving, I would read while I was driving. When you have to go through 40 books a month or more, you get a little tired. The students have given up great literature. It's like, you can't eat, grapes are wonderful. 750 pounds of grapes a week is like more than most people can handle.
Right. So there is a line of what is appropriate and what isn't. And I think back to my college days and waiting tables and reading a book between walking from one table to the other table to take their order and loving it. So I think partly it's a question of what do you want to do? How many books do you want to read? And partly it's a question of how much is too much? And it sounds like maybe what you experienced was too much. And I'm sorry to hear that, because really, I feel like the more books you read, the more you should want to read. And maybe should is the wrong word there. I feel like the more books you read, the more you will want to read. That has been my journey. That's been my path with literature. And I found it enlightening and inspiring. And I'm really sorry to hear that that it was English class. It was schooling that turned you off to reading. I think that's a great failing of the school. And I agree with you that if so many graduates don't want to read a book again, it's not the failing of the student, but it's also not a failing of the classics. It's a failing of the system, and that's really sad to hear.
Mike in Irondequoit, next. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. What a great conversation.
Thanks for calling.
Just real quick, most of the calls, I think, I've been listening for the whole hour, have come from the suburbs. And I had an opportunity to do a little bit of an experiment in the 90s with a Great Books program at a local private school. Sort of the majority of kids in it were from the core of the city of Rochester. The program became the Torrey Institute at Biola, ultimately, thanks to a guy by the name of John Reynolds. But how do we inspire some of these kids who are really hurting and struggling? Because I think this type of approach does lead, ultimately, and as we engage kids, to goodness and truth, right?
Right.
We want more good stuff, less violence, all of those things. We want to learn these lessons. How would we apply this kind of teaching and the instruction? My God, I wish I had you as a teacher. Jillian, I wish I had you as a student. because great teachers inspire great students, and great students inspire great students. So if you were to say a few things to the folks that are really pouring out their hearts, I know, in our city, in the city schools, with this type of approach, how do you encourage them to engage these kids toward goodness and truth, utilizing the kinds of things that we really should be reading and all of?
It is such a good question, Mike, and it is such an important question, because there is there's a bit of an air of privilege to this conversation.
Sure.
That there's time required, and for some kids in some communities, especially kids who don't have stable households and help at home and all of these things going on, kids have experienced trauma, it may be different. And I think Mike's point in question is a very, very good one. What do you think, Evan?
Absolutely, yes. But in some ways, literature can also be a great escape from some of those struggles that we're facing. And so literature is actually in many ways a great equalizer. Whether you're going through the best time of your life or the hardest time of your life, picking up a great book and really connecting with it, really relating to it, could be exactly what you need. Could be something that gives you the strength to persevere. Could be something that gives you the wisdom to know what you want to do and how you want to do it. And the way to encourage kids, and believe me, like I know, no matter how privileged of a district you're in, you're still dealing with teenagers. teenagers, and some of them still won't read, and some of them still don't want to and think that they have better things to do. The best thing that I have found is love what you do. I teach the books that I love. I teach the books that I'm absolutely passionate about. I walk in, I'm sorry if this sounds cheesy, but I am excited about the conversation that we're about to have. And so I think that often that communicates itself to the students, and I think it works, not 100% of the time, and I'd be silly to think that I get through to everybody, but that's the best thing that I've got going.
I think of what Jillian said about the importance of bridging, I don't know, pick anything, Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, bridging those texts to what's going on in our lives now is vital too strong a word to actually breaking through to get kids interested in some sense. I would think, to Mike's point, even more so for at-risk kids, kids who are maybe less likely to actually, because reading a book is a commitment, whether it's for leisure or because you have to do it for some work or student capacity, it's a commitment. And for at-risk kids, we know they read less than others. So relating it the way Jillian says, I think, is even more important. And I'm so glad Mike directed our attention to that. I think it's really important. Jillian, some final thoughts from you going forward. You graduated high school. You're going to keep reading, aren't you?
I am going to keep reading. Actually, most people are going off to college next year. I'm going to take a little break, and I'm going to read. I'm going to read until I'm learning strictly from intrinsic motivation. I'm not letting myself pursue higher education until I know I'm doing it because it's what I want to do, not because it's the default, not because it's going to get me a job, but because it's what I want to be learning. So...
love. Well, I've had so much enjoyment listening to you this hour. I'm so impressed. I'm so glad you've been here. Evie Fanning, some final thoughts on the value of teaching and reading the classics for our listeners. What would you want to leave with them?
There is nothing we can do that's more efficient, more effective, more valuable, whether you want a shortcut or you want a break or you want an escape or you want to approach truth and beauty and everything else. Literature is the path to all of that. So take it, do it, don't take it for granted. And especially if you're a student, because you will never have time to catch up on that stuff if you don't do it now. Nowhere else in your life is it going to be your job to sit down and read a great book. So while you're in high school and while that is your job, please do it. It's the best thing you can do for yourself.
Recently, Garrison Keillor of Prairie Home Companion announced they are setting an end date, at least for him, on Prairie Home Companion. And when he was on this program recently, he hadn't yet announced that, but he said, if I do finally really retire, you know what I'm going to go back to doing? Reading in the afternoon. He said, I read when I'm going to bed. I always fall asleep. I want to devote actual time in my life to reading. And wouldn't we all benefit from a little bit more of that? I thought that was such a great point. Evie Fanning, I love the conversation. You can come back anytime, and I think your Pittsford students are fortunate to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love being here. Thanks, Evan.
And Jillian, I have no worries about you. You're really going to do remarkable things, whatever you choose to do. Thanks for taking the time to come in.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening today. If we didn't get to your calls or your various emails and comments, we had so many this hour. Val LaBanca, Jane Eyre, we love you, Val. It's a great book anyway.
Sorry, Val.
Thanks for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.